Hello, this week's Brewing Podcast is with me, Guy Foster, speaking to Ian Lance of RWC, who is a value investor and has taken an unusual diversion into the field of macroeconomics. It's not intended as investment advice. We're living through history. Governments are using unthinkable policies. Investors are buying stocks like the world has changed completely, but on valuations that assume the macroeconomic environment is frozen in time. So we get Ian's perspective on the economic theory that squares that circle. MMT, Modern Monetary Theory. But bear in mind, we can't guarantee sources from outside Brewin Dolphin. Tax legislation and allowances can change. And remember, Ian picks stocks with confidence and conviction. But when investing, your capital is at risk, and we may hold any of the securities mentioned. Investment values may increase or decrease as a result of currency fluctuations, and future performance may differ from that of the past. But with those warnings issued, let's get on with the podcast. Hello everybody, welcome to another Brewin podcast, and on this edition we're going to be considering quite a big sort of macroeconomic topic, but we're going to do so with Ian Lance of RWC Asset Management, who is a value fund manager and therefore typically much more concerned with the sort of microeconomic aspects of investment rather than these sort of big macroeconomic aspects of investment. So the theme for this podcast is going to be something which Ian wrote on the subject of modern monetary theory. We'll introduce the concept in a moment, but some listeners may be familiar with it. It gets a lot of discussion on Twitter. But if before we get into that, Ian, perhaps you could start by explaining why you've chosen to take an interest in this area, which, as I say, is normally the prevail of economists rather than stock pickers.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. As you say, I'm a humble value investor, and the reason for writing this note really was I guess I was getting slightly fed up with people telling me that value investing will never work again until interest rates go up, and interest rates are never going to go up again, so therefore value investing can never work again. And it just struck me when I looked around the world that nearly all asset classes seem to be priced as if inflation is just never going to come back. And then I looked at what was going on in the real world and some of the themes that we'll come on to talk about. And it struck me actually that, you know, maybe the probability was greater than zero, which seems to be what's being priced into asset classes. And therefore, maybe it was just a good idea to examine, you know, how things were slightly different this time to during the financial crisis, and why, although I'm not going to go out there and predict that inflation is picking up, why people might like to just consider that it's a possibility.
Okay, well, that makes sense. And obviously, you mentioned inflation there, and, you know, for several decades, I guess, managing inflation evolved to become the number one objective of policy for a really long period of time. And inflation that was such a problem in the 70s has now been successfully suppressed, ostensibly by that inflation targeting approach that central banks kind of eventually found themselves adopting. So I guess the question to start off with is why is there a need for a modern monetary policy or any sort of change in the policy making environment after that success?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, because you're right, to a certain extent one can argue it's been successful, but I guess there are certain other aspects that haven't been successful. So number one, monetary policy hasn't really generated what I would call sustainable levels of growth. You know, post financial crisis, most countries have seen pretty lackluster growth, so it hasn't really worked there. It's failed to generate inflation above 2%, and that's the objective for most central banks. In most places, we haven't seen inflation above 2%, so it's failed there. I think most people would acknowledge that it's created a series of asset bubbles, whether that's in equities, bonds, and property, you know, right across the asset classes. So, you know, question mark, is that a success or a failure? I think even some central bankers are now admitting that those asset bubbles have led to inequality. That inequality has potentially fueled the rise in populism. So again, you know, a question mark there. And then the final thing that I would say is just the fact that we've become addicted to low interest rates and quantitative easing. When these measures are put into place, they're always said to be temporary, aren't they? So whether it's quantitative easing, low rates, et cetera, et cetera. But then they never seem to get reversed. You know, we come out of the crisis and you know, central banks' balance sheets don't shrink again. Interest rates don't go back up again. So they seem to have become a permanent fixture of life. So I think those are some of the reasons that are driving this debate.
That's interesting. And of course, we had that interview with Andy Haldane at the Bank of England, in which he sort of bemoaned the risk of a kind of dependency culture upon these forms of monetary easing as well. So why then, if that's the problem, why is this response not simply an expansion of fiscal policy, which I think was always the idea that would be something that worked alongside monetary policy?
Yeah, and you know, to a certain extent, I think it is. I think lots of people will now say monetary policy on its own can't work. A lot of people also say, you know, austerity can't work, and therefore you just need to sort of expand fiscal policy. The couple of issues around that is number one, and this is going to lead on to MMT. Ordinarily, that increase in fiscal policy leads to an increase in debt. And so this is another thing we've seen over the last few decades is that G7 debt to GDP has just carried on increasing. And I guess most people outside of the MMT crowd would say that is a finite process. So G7 debt to GDP before the financial crisis was about 80%. It's currently about 120% and forecast to go higher. The second thing is that I think most people would acknowledge that ever increasing levels of debt normally produce slower levels of economic growth. And so you get trapped in this sort of circle whereby you have to keep increasing debt, but GDP slows and therefore debt to GDP goes up as a ratio. And then the final thing is just the fact that this idea of sort of fiscal stimulus is fine if you're putting that spending into productive assets. But a lot of this spending doesn't go into productive assets. It goes into sort of welfare programs. So it goes into social security and other sorts of safety nets, which doesn't really generate economic growth. So that's, you know, I think that's some of the cautionary words around just expanding fiscal policy.
Okay, well, that is that's interesting, and also I guess a timely comment. We just had this summer statement from the Chancellor. In which he talked about phase three of the response from COVID, and phase three was about rebuilding, but it sounded a lot like repayment of all of this fiscal spending that's taken place. And certainly I think there's a lot of people now looking forward to that budget in November, or maybe not looking forward to it, but looking at it with a sense of dread about what might be coming down the track in an attempt to repay the some of the borrowing or reduce the deficit that has been run up in response to the COVID crisis.
Yeah.
So with that as a sort of scene setter, then perhaps you could explain what the premise and what the approach is that we mean when we describe modern monetary theory.
Yeah. Well, this is given what we were just discussing. This of course is why modern monetary theory has come very popular, because modern monetary theory basically says that money is a creation of the state, and basically sovereign governments can't run out of money because they basically can always just print more money. And basically what this means, if you believe that, is that you can disconnect fiscal spending from its financing, because you don't have to worry about actually, you know, raising the money that you're going to spend. You just spend first and you just print the money to finance it. And of course, those concepts are quite popular to quite a few people. Politicians, for a start, if you're telling politicians, you know what, you're not going to have to put through these um, these tax rises to finance this spending, because we all know that those tax rises tend to be politically unpopular. All you need to do is just print the money. You know, that's a pretty popular message to politicians. And MMT is, it's not that they don't believe that there should be any taxation at all. It's that they simply think that taxation is basically a way of slowing down inflation. So they typically believe that the only restraint on this money printing is inflation. And their answer to this is that the government will basically be able to anticipate this inflation as inflation starts to pick up, because we're using up all the productive resources in the economy. So you use increases in taxes to basically slow down the rate of inflation. But other than that, they would say that there are no constraints on government spending. So typically they would aim for, you know, government spending to produce things like full employment.
And so just with that as a description of MMT, then, of modern monetary theory, perhaps you just remind us, I mean, what's your axe to grind here? Are you advocating for this policy or warning about it, or what's your perspective?
No, I'm certainly not an advocate of it. I think it, you know, it potentially leads to all sorts of issues. For a start, I just simply don't buy the idea that just increasing the money supply leads to an increase in wealth. I think what it eventually leads to is a reduction in the value of the currency. And that's, you know, historically, that's certainly what we've seen. And I think, you know, it has the potential to lead to a loss of confidence in the currency, and a loss of confidence eventually leads to inflation, in my opinion. And I think, you know, I think it's a sort of, what slightly worries me about it is what I just mentioned. In other words, one can see how it's quite popular. You know, it's quite popular with financial markets because it tends to drive asset prices up. It's popular with politicians. But I think you are potentially creating some real problems if you go down that route.
OK, well, so you said it's popular. I mean, do you see, we haven't really seen much support from this from the central bankers or finance ministers, have we? It's mostly popular with intelligent people on Twitter in relatively small groups of discussion.
Yeah, it's a good point, actually. I think basically politicians and central bankers don't like to admit that this is what's going on, but the reality is I think this is basically going on already. If not explicitly, then implicitly. So what I mean by that is, you know, both here and in the US, we're going to run absolutely colossal deficits this year. Have we had to increase taxes to finance that? No, we haven't. You know, are we going to? Well, you know, we'll see, but it doesn't look like it at the moment. Have bond yields gone up as a result of all that increase in borrowing? No, they've gone down. You know, why have they gone down? They've gone down basically because the central banks are going into the market and they're buying the bonds that the governments are issuing. And yes, there might be a sort of slight delay in it. You know, the bonds might exist in the markets for a few days before the central bank comes in and buys them. But in essence, that is what is going on already. So although they wouldn't like to admit it, I think we, you know, we have started to go down this route.
So do you think, I suppose the test may be then in November, when the budget's issued, whether there is any effort to restrain public spending, because I suppose that's going to be the ultimate kind of decisive factor about whether this remains a sort of continuation of policy, probably becomes or potentially becomes quite Japanese-like, where you had big deficits and they didn't generate any inflation, or whether it does become something different, which can put the world on a different path, if there is much less effort made to try and restrain the public spending side of things.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. There's there's actually quite a good article in the Spectator this week, which was quite topical. It's entitled "The Magic Money Tree." And actually, they discuss in there whether Andrew Bailey, the chairman of the Bank of England, is basically going to try and step away from this. He drops hints that he might, but you know, but we'll see. And interestingly, they quote, although they don't name him, they quote a senior Tory politician saying that basically if the Bank of England stop financing the government's deficit spending, he says, I think it's 50-50 that number 10 tries to renationalise the Bank of England, which I find just absolutely fascinating slash terrifying.
So your view then is that we're already seeing central banks financing government spending then?
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
And you've obviously talked a little bit about it already, but what do you think the implications of that would be?
I think I guess if we step back a second, I think potentially the implications are inflationary, and I think I'm always a huge respecter of the wisdom of crowds. Now, the wisdom of crowds at the moment is telling you that there's not going to be any pickup in inflation. And I just wonder if people basically are suffering from recency bias. So in other words, they're looking at what happened post the financial crisis and saying we had QE then and we didn't get any inflation. So why are we going to get, you know, any inflation now? Surely it's just the same. I guess what I'm trying to point out in this note is that I think there are some quite significant differences. So the first one is just the scale of the monetary intervention. So, to give you an example, the Fed's balance sheet is going to expand by 40% of GDP. That is more than the 20% that they did in QE1, QE2 and QE3 combined. And they've done that, in a matter of months. So the scale is much bigger. The deficits that governments are going to run are again, much, much bigger. So both in this country and in the US, we're talking about 20% of GDP. I mean, that you have to go back to the Second World War to see those sorts of deficits. We've mentioned already, I believe these deficits are being funded by the central banks. That is a big difference from what happened before. Another thing that does concern me, I touched on this a few minutes ago, is, I suppose, this loss of central bankers' independence. So, you now actually have to go back quite a long way. You have to go back almost to the sort of Paul Volcker days to see a central banker who was willing to stand up and do the unpopular things because he thought it was the right thing to do for the economy. Not much sign of that these days. And actually, we're almost sort of seeing the opposite. So, Jay Powell seems to be very, very, very happy to sort of bow down to either President Trump or the stock market's demands. In Europe, we've seen Christine Lagarde saying that she's open to the idea of the ECB using its tools to effect change towards a green transition in the economy. These are quite different words coming out of central bankers. And I'm just going to mention one other one, and then I'll pause, which is this actually came out of a piece of research that Russell Napier produced a couple of weeks ago. And the interesting difference that he was highlighting here is that governments have actually started to a certain extent to circumvent the central banks. What he means by this is that they're actually using the commercial banks to get money into the system. So you think of something like the bounce back loan that goes through the commercial banking system. And so, one of the reasons the QE historically didn't lead to inflation was that a lot of the money basically just sort of ended up trapped within the canyons of Wall Street, as they call it. It basically just ended up as reserves at the Federal Reserve. This time, actually, we've got a different route, where they're using the commercial banks. And I think a lot of that money is getting into the real system. And again, I looked up some figures this morning. This is growth in broad money at the end of May. So this is year-on-year growth. In the UK, we're seeing 10% growth. In the US, 25% growth. In Europe, 10% growth. We literally haven't seen that sort of growth in broad money since about 1973. And so, it does strike me that, a lot of what's going on does eventually have the possibility to create inflation.
And so to bring this back then to your day job, so to speak,
yeah,
you if we were to have the scenario that you're seeing as a possibility, one in which we see a big pickup in inflation driven by this change in monetary policy, you know, how does that, what effect is that going to have on stocks? What's that going to mean depending upon what kind of stocks you hold?
Yeah, I think, you know, again, that's a really good question. Again, my reason for writing this is I think a lot of people that potentially have their portfolios facing completely the wrong way if we do start to see an increase in inflation. And what I mean by that is, for the last 10 years or so, we've seen nothing but interest rates come down, inflation be under control. And people have reacted to that, you know, maybe as you would expect. So obviously bonds have performed well. But within the equity market, things like bond proxies, so you could call it quality growth or whatever you want to call it, so typically, you know, consumer staple companies, that sort of thing, have performed very, very well. If we saw a pickup in inflation and that eventually led to an increase in interest rates, I suspect not only would that not continue, but actually we might start to see, you know, a complete reversal of that. And actually, those actually might be the last sorts of stocks that you wanted. And what I did was in this note, actually, I looked at, I suppose I compared, you know, what I'm saying might happen with the last time that it did happen, which was the 1970s. And during the 1970s, obviously, we had high inflation. And the best performing stocks, as the best performing sectors, were areas like energy, industrials, materials. You know, interestingly, information technology was the worst performing sector. Consumer staples, again, didn't do particularly well at all. So, you know, if you saw that sort of increase in inflation and interest rates, then it might, you might almost get a sort of 180 degree reversal of the types of stocks that perform.
So what performs well in that kind of environment then, sir?
Well, it's typically, as you'd expect, it's sectors that benefit from increasing prices. So energy materials are a really, really good example of that. But also, you go from a scenario where actually having high asset intensity is a good thing in that sort of environment. So industrials, you know, perform much, much better than healthcare and as I say, information technology. And I think, you know, the other really interesting potential comparison with that period is that we went into the 1970s, and I'm sure you would have heard of the you know, the expression the Nifty 50. So we went into the 1970s. There was a group of, you know, quality growth stocks back then it was sort of Xerox, IBM, Polaroid, Coca-Cola, etc. Leaders in their industry, you know, strong balance sheets, high profitability, high return on capital, etc. And everyone wanted to own those stocks going into that period. And just like today's quality growth stocks, they became very, very expensive. And it's fascinating. I actually put a chart in here to look at the performance of them as you went into the 70s. So 1 year after the trough, which was in 1974, the market was down 35. The Nifty 50 were down 52. If you go sort of 3 years after the trough, the market's now actually up 1, the Nifty 50 down 31. 5 years after the trough, market up 26, Nifty 50 down 16, you know, and so on and so forth. And what's fascinating is that actually operationally, most of those companies lived up to their expectations over that period. It's just that the valuations were so high going into it that they suffered a derating as inflation started to pick up. And basically that derating overwhelmed, you know, all of the growth in profits and more. So they ended up being very poor investments, despite the fact that the companies themselves, actually operationally performed okay.
And so that's a reflection of the discount rate then. It's a reflection of the interest rate that's prevailing in the market rather than how much profit the company does or doesn't make. Is that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You know, when I talk about a derating, that's effectively what the derating is, isn't it? It's the discount rate changing. And as the discount rate changes, it hits those sorts of companies harder. Just as over the last few years, you know, the discount rate coming down has favoured those companies the most.
Now, I want to ask you about a sector that has been the sort of mainstay of a lot of value investors' portfolios over the last decade or so, and not to a great effect, And that's the financials. And increasingly, when we talk about the difference between growth and value, people tend to kind of focus on whether the banks are able to recover, whether they're able to kind of return to strong growth or not. Does this environment have implications for financials?
Yeah, again, it's sort of, I suppose it depends exactly what happens. And also depends on your starting point. I'd have to go back and look what the starting point was like back then. But I suppose if you start at today's starting point, number one, most of the financials are in significantly better state than they were in 10 years ago. So as we know, not only are their balance sheets much, much stronger, but their loan books are much, much better as well. So I think that, the quality of businesses is actually better. Number two, the valuations at the moment are, just basically discounting them never making their return on capital again, aren't they? So roughly speaking, you can say that if you think a bank is going to make its cost of capital, it should trade on, roughly 1x its tangible book. Lots of them are trading on sort of 0.3, 0.4 times book. So basically, the market is saying we just don't think these things can ever basically make a serious amount of money again. And I suppose the last point is that if interest rates start to increase, then that does potentially help the net interest margin of some of these businesses. So it potentially increases profitability. Of course, the caveat on that is what happens to loan losses. So if we get an increase in inflation and it is accompanied by a large pickup in loan losses, then obviously that would be not good for profitability. If it doesn't, and I as I said, their loan book is a lot higher quality than it was a few years ago, then that increase in interest rates is potentially helpful for them.
Okay, well, look, that's been really, really useful. I think before we go though, it'd be really, really good to just get an understanding that this is a possibility further on down the track, but you've obviously got to run a fund right now. So how do you manage a portfolio with this as a possibility? Is it something that you'd be kind of ready to react to? Is it something that you've got a position for now, or trust that your portfolio is going to be resilient to? What kind of things are you doing, having develop this kind of potential vision of the future?
Yeah, it's interesting actually, because we would always say to people that we never sort of take a macro view and then build a portfolio around it. And the reason for that is number one, we don't think we, nor is anybody else particularly great at macro forecasting. But if you do that and your macro view is wrong, then potentially your entire portfolio is wrong. So that's why we don't tend to do that. Now, as it happens, because the view of that basically inflation is never going to pick up and interest rates are going to stay low forever seems to be factored into the market, that has implications for what has become expensive and what's become cheap within the market. So, the expensive areas in the market are, sort of technology, consumer staples and so on and so forth. The cheaper areas of the market are cyclicals, financials, energy materials, et cetera, et cetera. And because we see our job as basically rotating around to the market to where we think the value is, we're largely exposed to those sorts of sectors. Now, as it happens, if the 70s was any guide, if that scenario that I was talking about plays out, then I suspect a lot of those sectors would do well. The reality, though, is that even if it doesn't, I think the starting valuations are so low in those sorts of areas that we think potentially there are some sort of quite good returns baked into them anyway.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a good note to end on then. So thanks, Ian. Really good of you to join us and talk us through this vision of modern monetary theory and the impact that it could have on the economy, but also on the equity market. And thanks also to all of our listeners. Hopefully you found this a useful non-economist's guide to an economic scenario. And hopefully you'll join us again as well on the next Bruin podcast. Thanks for listening.